They don't have time for the games played in Washington.
This really throws Donald Trump's plan for a loop, which was Biden won't do this, and so you need me to come in and do it. Now, I think it's not really a great plan with regard to actually fixing the immigration problems that we have, but we'll get to that in a moment. Here is President Joe Biden explaining what this means for asylum seekers.
But Republicans left me no choice. Today, I'm announcing actions to bar migrants who cross our southern border unlawfully from receiving asylum. Migrants will be restricted from asylum at our southern border unless they seek it after entering through an established lawful process. And those who seek to come to the United States legally, for example, by making an appointment and coming to a port of entry, asylum will still be available to them.
All right, so listen, the point here is if you enter the U.S. illegally, you can no longer make an asylum claim. If you find some other legal means to get into the United States, at that point you can say, hey, I'd like to request asylum. Is this going to endanger some migrants who are in dangerous situations in their home countries? Yes, it is. It would be the case whether Biden did it or Trump did it. I don't think this is a really tremendous idea, but it's what Republicans say they wanted. It's what Republicans said Biden isn't willing to do it, and you have to hand it to him from a political strategy standpoint. Now, I'd prefer to deal with this, number one, by dealing with the conditions in the source countries that make people want to come to the United States and risk coming illegally in the first place. This doesn't do that. I'd like to see our capacity to adjudicate asylum claims ramped up dramatically. We need more immigration judges. We need to be able to process more of these claims and process them more quickly. That's not what this does. To his credit, Joe Biden agrees that that's actually what we need to do.
Today, I'm joined by a bipartisan group of governors, members of Congress, mayors, law enforcement officials, most of whom live and work along the southern border. They know the border is not a political issue to be weaponized. Responsibility we have to share to do something about it. They don't have time for the games played in Washington, and neither do the American people. So today, I'm moving past Republican obstruction and using the executive authorities available to me as president to do what I can on my own to address the border. Frankly, I would have preferred to address this issue through a bipartisan legislation because that's the only way to actually get the kind of system we have now that's broken, fixed, to hire more Border Patrol agents, more asylum officers, more judges. But Republicans left me no choice.
This is really a bungling for Republicans. They could have been up there with Biden saying he did this because of us. This is our bill. But Trump told them you got to torpedo the bill because I need something to say you should vote for me so that I will do it when I am president. And now Joe Biden gets to go up there and tout this all by himself. Now, we had a discussion on the bonus show yesterday. This is nominally something. I don't know how many people you attract versus you repel with this. And when the election will come down to 500,000 votes in 3 to 5 states, one of those 3 to 5 states maybe being Arizona, maybe there's a calculation here from Biden, which is, hey, you know what? This might upset some people who are already planning to vote for me in California, but California I'm going to win easily. But this will bring me some new votes in Arizona, which is a contested state that is not going to necessarily be so easy for me. So there may be a political calculation here that's made looking at the electoral map. I can't really tell you. What I can tell you is that this is what Republicans wanted. They didn't do it, and now Biden is doing it and making the point, by the way, that he is not going to be demonizing immigrants.
I believe that immigration has always been a lifeblood of America. We're constantly renewed by an infusion of people and new talent. The Statue of Liberty is not some relic of American history. It stands for who we are as the United States. So I will never demonize immigrants. I'll never refer to immigrants as poisoning the blood of a country. And further, I'll never separate children from their families at the border.
Speaking of poisoning the blood of our country, in an interview responding to this statement, Trump melted down and said exactly that. We'll get to that in a moment. So, is this a politically astute calculation from President Joe Biden, or is it a mistake? Well, when it comes to the states that are in question, it certainly seems to, again, cross off another item from the list of why someone might vote for Donald Trump, because now Biden did the thing. Let's talk about how Trump reacted. after President Joe Biden went right around Republicans and signed an executive order to do exactly what Trump says he would do, stop the crossing at the border, make the asylum claims be made in Mexico or source countries rather than in the United States. After Biden did this, Donald Trump gave an interview.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Like the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs, we are having an outsized impact. In the case of climate, we are not the dinosaurs. We are the meteor. We are not only in danger, we are the danger.
Deadly heat. As we enter the month of June, record scorching temperatures are already taking hold around the world, from California to Texas, Mexico to India. We'll speak with a climate scientist in the Yucatan, where it's so hot in Mexico, howler monkeys are falling dead from the trees. And we'll talk to a climate reporter about the heat wave scenario that keeps climate scientists up at night. Then, Israel illegally drops white phosphorus on residential areas in southern Lebanon. We'll go to Beirut to speak with Human Rights Watch. Then, black women's voices are the focus of a project from V-Day, the global activist movement to end violence against all women, gender expansive people, girls, and the earth. It's called Voices, a sacred sisterscape.
You are the sun. Where are you running to? Mother asked, deeply concerned as we darted to hide under the shade. A shield from the sun? The cracks on our skin, she said, are a celebration of life.
We'll speak with Grammy-nominated poet, Voices director Aja Monet, and playwright V, formerly known as Eve Ensler. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel struck another UN school in Gaza where displaced Palestinians had sought shelter. Al Jazeera reports several people were killed in today's attack on the UNRWA school in the Shati refugee camp west of Gaza City. This comes a day after an Israeli strike on a UN school in the Nusayrat refugee camp killed at least 40 Palestinians. Video footage has confirmed U.S. munitions were used in Thursday's strike. The New York Times reports remnants of the Boeing-made GBU-39 bomb were uncovered. Al Jazeera also published photographs of a missile fragment made by Honeywell. The UN school had been turned into a shelter for displaced Palestinians. At least 14 children were reportedly killed in Thursday's attack. A number of other children were injured, including Imad al-Makadmeh, who spoke to a reporter as he lay on the floor of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah.
Why did they bomb us? Why? I want to know why. Why? We are all children in the school. There are no armed people. I don't know why they bombed it. Where should we go? Where? Where should we go? Here or there?
Israel claims Thursday's strike on the UN school targeted Hamas militants, but Israel's presented no evidence to back up the claim. In other news, the UN's warning of a possible cholera outbreak in Gaza this summer due to a severe lack of clean water. In Washington, D.C., congressional leaders have confirmed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will address a joint session of Congress July 24th. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, along with Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, joined together to invite Netanyahu. In a letter, they wrote, quote, "We invite you to share the Israeli government's vision for defending democracy, combating terror, and establishing a just and lasting peace in the region," unquote. The invitation comes just weeks after the head prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, announced he's seeking an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for committing war crimes. A number of lawmakers have vowed to boycott the speech, including independent Senator Bernie Sanders. In related news, CNN is reporting the CIA has circulated a new assessment that concludes Netanyahu will likely defy pressure from the Biden administration to end the war on Gaza and set a post-war plan. This comes as the Israeli military has announced it signed a $3 billion deal with the United States to buy 25 F-35 stealth fighter jets built by Lockheed Martin. Israeli officials say the war planes will be financed by U.S. military aid to Israel. This comes despite growing calls for the U.S. to cut off arms sales to Israel. On Thursday, the NAACP called on President Biden to draw a red line and halt arms shipments to Israel, citing the mounting death toll in Gaza, where over 36,700 Palestinians have been killed in the past 8 months. This is NAACP CEO Derek Johnson.
We witnessed it, individuals in Gaza who are civilians being attacked, and they went to what was supposed to be the safe zones. These are things that are avoidable. The United States must take a moral stand to protect civilian innocent children and lives.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinians and wounded at least 13 in a raid on the city of Jenin on Thursday. The group Defense for Children International reports the dead included a 16-year-old named Issa Nafez Musa Jalad, who sustained gunshot wounds to his leg, back, and back of the head. The Biden administration's announced it'll send another $225 million in military aid to Ukraine, including munitions that could be used to strike targets inside Russia. Earlier today, President Biden met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Paris and apologized for the months-long holdup in new U.S. assistance for Ukraine. On Thursday, President Biden spoke about Ukraine during a speech in Normandy, France, to mark the 80th anniversary of D-Day, when 150,000 Allied soldiers invaded France to drive out the Nazis.
And make no mistake, the autocrats of the world are watching closely to see what happens in Ukraine, to see if we let this illegal aggression go unchecked. We cannot let that happen. To surrender to bullies, to bow down to dictators, is simply unthinkable.
In related news, Russian President Vladimir Putin's threatening to send long-range missiles to allies of Moscow that could be used against nations sending similar weapons to Ukraine.
We think that if someone thinks it is possible to supply such weapons to a combat zone to strike at our territory and create problems for us, why do we not have the right to supply our weapons of the same class to those regions of the world where there will be strikes on the sensitive facilities of those countries that are doing this against Russia?
In a major legal victory for Donald Trump, an appeals court in Georgia's indefinitely paused the election subversion conspiracy case against the former president. The decision means the trial, if it even happens, will likely be delayed until after the election. The appeals court put the case on hold as judges review a lower court's decision not to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis. A federal judge has ordered former Trump advisor Steve Bannon to report to prison July 1st to serve a 4-month sentence for contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with a subpoena issued by the House January 6 committee. In Sudan, over 100 people, including dozens of children, were killed after Rapid Support Forces fighters stormed a village in the Al Jazeera state Wednesday, indiscriminately firing at civilians. Survivors of the massacre described the carnage, saying over 40 armed RSF vehicles raided the village of Wad Al Nur, unleashing heavy weaponry. The RSF has claimed it was targeting the Sudanese army, but village residents say there's no military presence in the region. The UN's condemned the attack, while the International Organization for Migration warns the number of displaced people over the intensifying conflict in Sudan could soon reach 10 million. This comes as the European Union's expected to impose sanctions on 6 members of the Sudanese military and the RSF over accusations of war crimes as both sides fight for control of Sudan's Darfur region. In South Korea, thousands of workers at Samsung Electronics went on strike today for the first time in the company's history. Some 28,000 union members have joined the one-day action. That's nearly a quarter of Samsung's entire workforce in South Korea. They're demanding salary increases and bonuses as Samsung, which produces smartphones, electronics, and memory chips, has reported billions of dollars in profits. This is Samsung Workers Union leader Son Woo-mak.
We're approaching the fifth year since the labor union was founded, but the management still refuses to recognize the union and continues to neglect it, ignoring the voices of the employees or the labor union without any communication.
New York Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul's facing growing criticism after she abruptly halted a plan to charge drivers $15 to enter parts of Manhattan. Up until this week, Hochul had advocated for congestion pricing as a way to raise money for public transit and to reduce car emissions in the city. Climate advocate Bill McKibben described Hochul's abandonment of the program as one of the most aggressive anti-environmental actions ever undertaken by a Democratic governor. In media news, the Washington-based news outlet, The Hill, has fired Breonna Joy Gray, the co-host of Rising, The Hill's daily morning show. Gray's been a vocal critic of Israel's war on Gaza. Last year, The Hill also fired the political commentator Katie Halper after she called Israel an apartheid state. And the Columbia Law Review website is back online after its board of directors took down the site Monday when student editors refused a request from the board to halt the publication of an academic legal article written by Palestinian human rights lawyer Rabia Akbaria, titled Toward Nakba as a Legal State. But the controversy has not ended. Student editors at the Law Review have voted to go on strike after the board added a disclaimer statement about the Nakba article on the review's website. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Rabia Akbaria. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces have illegally dropped white phosphorus munitions on densely populated residential areas in southern Lebanon, forcing many residents to flee. That's according to a new report by Human Rights Watch documenting Israel's use of the chemical in at least 17 municipalities across southern Lebanon since October, including five towns where the shells struck several residential buildings. White phosphorus poses a high risk of excruciating burns and lifelong suffering, and its use as an incendiary weapon in civilian areas is a war crime, which under U.S. law should have implications for continuous military aid to Israel. The Intercept's Ryan Grimm questioned State Department spokesperson Matt Miller Thursday about the Human Rights Watch report.
We've seen tons of reports now about the use of white phosphorus by the IDF. 17 municipalities across southern Lebanon since October, according to HRW. So does U.S. have any policy that it, with regard to the use of white phosphorus?
So
setting aside whether or not these individual incidents occur.
Yeah. So white phosphorus is something that's commonly used in military operations to produce smoke, to obscure ground forces, mark locations, or provide illumination. And just the usage by itself is not something that's prohibited under international humanitarian law. But as with any type of military operation, civilians can't be targeted. If white phosphorus is used, precautions have to be taken to minimize harm to civilians, and it's incumbent on countries to use white phosphorus in ways that are consistent with international humanitarian law.
Are these incidents concerning that Human Rights Watch is saying that they were outside the bounds of?
So I've seen the reports, but that is the type of thing that we'd have to take a look at and assess before commenting in detail.
That was State Department spokesperson Matt Miller being questioned by The Intercept's Ryan Grimm. After one Israeli attack on October 15th, at least two people from the village of Bustan had to be rushed to the hospital after inhaling white phosphorus smoke. Lebanon's Ministry of Public Health says at least 173 people have been injured in the white phosphorus attacks, which have also caused hundreds of forest fires in Lebanon. Lebanon. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Ramzi Kais, a researcher in the Middle East and North Africa division at Human Rights Watch, investigating human rights abuses in Lebanon, lead author of the group's new report called Lebanon, Israel's White Phosphorus Use Risks Civilian Harm. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ramzi. Just lay out what you understand is happening in southern Lebanon right now when it comes to the use of Israeli military use of white phosphorus.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for having me. As you noted, we released a report today documenting Israel's widespread use of white phosphorus in South Lebanon. And what we found is that this widespread use is putting civilians at grave risk and also contributing to displacement. As part of our research, our arms experts and digital investigations team reviewed over 100 photos and videos and identified the use of white phosphorus munitions in 47 of them. And when possible, we geolocated precisely identified where those munitions had fell. In total, we found that white phosphorus was used in at least 17 municipalities, stretching from southwest Lebanon near the Mediterranean all the way to the southeast near the occupied Golan Heights. And in five of those municipalities, we identified the use of white phosphorus munitions over populated residential areas. As part of the research, we spoke to eight residents from the south, including the mayors of three of the towns where white phosphorus was unlawfully used. And what they told us was, you know, at the time of the attacks, many of these villages were still populated. There were people in them. In the case of Al Bustan, which you had mentioned, the mayor said that, you know, nearly all the village was still there. But when the attacks happened, two people were injured. In a separate town in Kfarkila, the mayor told us that overall between 20 to 25 people had been injured from white phosphorus use. And all the mayors that we spoke to had said that it, you know, turned the towns into a militarized zone and pushed people out of their villages. As you noted, the Ministry of Health had said that, you know, at least 173 people as of May 28 have been injured as a result of exposure to white phosphorus. And we heard just about the fears that people have from its use in the south. We think that the widespread use of white phosphorus in South Lebanon, you know, that there should be action taken. On the one hand, Israel should immediately prohibit the use of airburst white phosphorus munitions in populated areas because of the risk of indiscriminate attacks on civilians and the harm that we're seeing being caused to civilians. Also, you know, the widespread use shows that there's a need for stronger international law on the use of white phosphorus, and I'm happy to speak more on that. And we also made a call to the Lebanese government to file a declaration with the International Criminal Court, giving it the jurisdiction to prosecute and investigate crimes committed within its jurisdiction since October 7. The government made a decision on this about a month ago, but then backtracked on it, unfortunately.
So explain exactly international law when it comes to the use of white phosphorus, if you can go into that in more detail. And also, what about U.S. law?
Sure. Let me just start by saying that with white phosphorus, you know, it's a chemical substance that's dispersed in artillery fire, shells, bombs, and rockets, and it has incendiary effects. As you had mentioned, that can cause death or lifelong sufferings. It can set homes and agricultural areas and other civilian objects on fire, and, you know, continues burning until either it's cut off from oxygen or the white phosphorus is depleted. So when it comes to contact with people, it can burn down to the bone and cause lifelong suffering. Now, it can also be used as a military tool, you know, to create smoke screens to obscure the movement of troops or to mark or signal a certain area. And it also interferes with infrared systems and weapon tracking systems. But under international humanitarian law, the use of airburst white phosphorus is unlawfully indiscriminate in populated areas and also does not meet the legal requirement to take all necessary precautions to avoid civilian harms. And these concerns are, you know, amplified given the way in which we're seeing white phosphorus used, particularly in South Lebanon and in Gaza, where it's airburst over a certain area. And when that happens, the 116 felt wedges impregnated with white phosphorus can spread over an area of 125 meters to 250 meters, depending on the height and angle of burst, and indiscriminately cause harm to civilians and civilian objects in that area. And so With regards to international law, when it's used as a weapon, white phosphorus is considered an incendiary weapon. And now, incendiary weapons are not explicitly banned under international humanitarian law, but customary international humanitarian law maintains that all parties to a conflict need to take all feasible precautions to caused by these weapons. The only legally binding instrument with regards to incendiary weapon is Protocol 3 of the Convention on Conventional Weapons. Lebanon is a state party, Israel is not, but the Protocol 3 has two significant loopholes. On the one hand, it defines incendiary weapons as weapons that are primarily designed to set fires or cause burns, whereas so therefore it excludes multipurpose munitions like white phosphorus. And also it has much weaker language on the use of ground-launched incendiary weapons. So what we're saying in Gaza and Lebanon, where it's artillery-fired projectiles, they're ground-launched and then they're airbursts within an area. And so this is why we have long called for the closing of these loopholes and for stronger international law on the use of incendiary weapons.
I wanted to go back to what Human Rights Watch confirmed in Gaza. In October, it reports that it had confirmed Israel using firing white phosphorus munitions during attacks on Gaza, as well as along its border with Lebanon. Israel denied using white phosphorus, but previously had used the white phosphorus in attacks on the Gaza Strip, including in 2009. Israel's military initially said it was currently not aware of the use of weapons containing white phosphorus in Gaza. Later it said, quote, "The current accusation regarding the use of white phosphorus in Gaza is unequivocally false." Meanwhile, the new Human Rights Watch report on Lebanon also notes the Israeli military said its main smoke shells do not contain white phosphorus, but stated that, similar to many Western armies, the IDF also has smoke shells that contain white phosphorus, and the choice to use them is influenced by operational considerations and availability compared to alternatives, unquote. The military further said that such munitions are intended for smoke screens and not for an attack or ignition, the report said. Can you explain all of this, Ramzi Qais?
Sure. I'll just start off by saying that, you know, Human Rights Watch documented the use of white phosphorus back in 2009 in Gaza, and then subsequently since October until today. We first documented it in October in South Lebanon and in Gaza, and then subsequently after that report, the Israeli military or the spokesperson denied, the military using white phosphorus. But after that, several other rights groups, including Amnesty International, for example, documented the use of white phosphorus unlawfully in the southern Lebanese town of Taira. Washington Post then did an investigation and found that the Israeli military used U.S. weapons in an attack that Amnesty said should be investigated as a war crime. In response to this, the statement that you just mentioned came from the Israeli military, where they said, you know, that some of the smoke shells have white phosphorus and they're used to create smoke screens, and that, you know, their use of white phosphorus complies and goes beyond the requirements of international law. What our report, I think, shows is, in fact, that, you know, it's being used unlawfully. It's being used on unresidential populated areas. It's causing harm to civilians, and it's causing displacement in the south.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Beirut. Ramzi Qais, Human Rights Watch researcher investigating human rights abuses in Lebanon, lead author of the new report from HRW, Lebanon, Israel's White Phosphorus Use Risks Civilian Harm. This final description of the effects of white phosphorus from the Human Rights Watch report, while white phosphorus that contacts people can burn down to the bone, fragments of white phosphorus can exacerbate wounds even after treatment and can enter the bloodstream and cause multiple organ failures. Already dressed wounds can reignite when dressings are removed and the wounds are re-exposed to oxygen. Even relatively minor burns are often fatal. For survivors, extensive scarring tightens muscle tissue and creates physical disabilities. The trauma of the attack, the painful treatment that follows, and appearance-changing scars lead to psychological harm and social exclusion. Next up, deadly heat. As we enter this month, record scorching temperatures across the globe, We'll speak with a climate scientist in Mexico. Howler monkeys are falling from the trees. We'll also talk to a climate reporter about the heat wave scenario that keeps climate scientists up at night. Back in 20 seconds. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees, Bayanoni. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Deadly heat. As we enter the month of June, scorching temperatures are already gripping parts of Arizona, California, Nevada, as well as countries around the world. In Arizona, extreme heat sent 11 people to the hospital as thousands waited to enter a campaign rally with Donald Trump. In India, 33 poll workers died from heat stroke on a single day last week during India's national elections. In Mexico, it's so hot, howler monkeys are falling dead from the trees. Data confirmed last month was the hottest May on record, putting the Earth on a 12-month streak of record scorching and breaking temperatures. Meanwhile, a new report has found the rate Earth is warming hit an all-time high last year, with 92% of 2023 record heat caused by humans. On Wednesday, the World Meteorological Organization announced there's an 80% chance the average global temperature will exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels for at least one of the next 5 years. On the same day that report was released, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave a major speech on the climate crisis right next to the dinosaurs at the American Museum of Natural History here in New York City. The UN Secretary General said the world can still meet the 1.5 degrees target if governments drastically speed up the phase out of fossil fuels.
Today is World Environment Day. It is also the day that the European Commission's Copernicus Climate Change Service officially reports May 2024 as the hottest May in recorded history. This marks 12 straight months of the hottest months ever. For the past year, every turn of the calendar has turned up the heat. Our planet is trying to tell us something, but we don't seem to be listening. Dear friends, the American Museum of Natural History is the ideal place to make the point. This great museum tells the amazing story of our natural world, of the vast forces that have shaped life on Earth over billions of years. And humanity is just one small blip on the radar. But like the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs, we are having an outsized impact. In the case of climate, we are not the dinosaurs. We are the meteor. We are not only in danger, we are the danger, but we are also the solution. So, dear friends, we are at a moment of truth. The truth is, almost 10 years since the Paris Agreement was adopted, the target of limiting long-term global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is hanging by a thread. The truth is, the world is spewing emissions so fast that by 2030, a far higher temperature rise would be all but guaranteed.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in a major address on the climate crisis Wednesday to mark World Environment Day. Again, he was speaking at the Museum of Natural History here in New York. For more on deadly heat and the climate crisis, we're joined by two guests. Dr. Ruth Sedes Omota is a researcher at the Institute of Engineering at UNAM, the National Autonomous University of Mexico. She is joining us from the city of Mérida in the Mexican state of Yucatan. And joining us from North Carolina, Jeff Goodell. He's covered the climate crisis for over 20 years at Rolling Stone magazine, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. He's got a new op-ed in the New York Times, The Heat Wave Scenario That Keeps Climate Scientists Up at Night. What is that scenario, Jeff?
Well, that scenario is a look at what would happen if there were a five-day blackout during an extreme heat wave, looking at the kind of cascading consequences of these two events together. It was based on a study done by some researchers at Georgia Tech and Arizona State University, and it looked at, you know, we think of air conditioning as this sort of techno fix for extreme heat. You know, often people will say to me, what's the problem with the planet heating up? We just got to get more people air conditioning. And this study really looked at the sort of false illusion of security that air conditioning has kind of provided for us. It showed that in this blackout scenario, where you had a total blackout for 2 days and then 3 days of restoring power, which is not kind of beyond the pale of kind of reality at all. We had a five-day blackout similar to that in Texas a few years ago. In that kind of a scenario, in a city like Phoenix, where there's virtually 100% penetration of air conditioning, you would have 800,000 emergency room visits and more than 13,000 deaths within 48 hours, which is hugely shocking and sort of disturbing findings. And what's interesting about this is the way that it shows that some of these that techno fixes like air conditioning and things, which are certainly important tools for living in hot climates, but they also amplify our vulnerability in ways that we don't really understand or are not aware of. And so air conditioning is sort of like this sort of sword of Damocles hanging over a city like Phoenix or a city like Austin or Houston or places like that that are completely dependent upon it. And it just shows this sort of our understanding of our vulnerability to extreme heat is far more complicated than we understand at first glance.
I mean, it's amazing, this report. In Phoenix, about 800,000 people, roughly half the population, would need emergency medical treatment for heat stroke and other illnesses. The flood of people seeking care would overwhelm the city's hospitals. More than 13,000 people would die. That's in Phoenix. And of course, that's a place that 99% of the buildings are air conditioned. Then you go to a place like Detroit that's even older, much less AC, and the number of people that would be affected, especially older people. And of course, AC causes more global warming. I was really struck in your piece by what you called not a Hurricane Katrina, but a heat Katrina.
Yeah, exactly. And in this study, in comparing the three cities, the other in Atlanta and Detroit and Phoenix, the emergency room visits and death rate as a consequence of this five-day blackout that I described are far lower in these other cities because of less dependence upon air conditioning. So in some ways, this one of our sort of favorite techno fixes for a hotter world, air conditioning, is increasing our vulnerability to that extreme heat. We're building buildings that don't have natural ventilation, that you know, you can't open windows in. So when the power goes out, they become like convection ovens, and people die. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we can do to reduce this vulnerability. things like solar panels on rooftops, microgrids, battery backup, so we're not so dependent upon the grid itself, and also building buildings that have passive cooling, that don't require air conditioning, that have natural ventilations, that are built in ways that are suitable for the hotter world that we're building for ourselves.
And of course, most of the rest of the world doesn't have that kind of access to air conditioning. I want to go down to the Yucatan, where our next guest is, Ruth Cerezo Mota. We just read this report about howler monkeys falling dead out of trees. If you can go from monkeys to human beings and what it means for Mexico right now, which is also, and Yucatan experienced a major heat wave, and yet at the same time, you've just elected your first woman president in Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, who is a climate scientist like yourself. In Mexico, nearly 61 people died from a record heat wave that just ended. Can you talk about all of this?
Yeah, hi. We are experiencing really extreme weather, and I just want to complement something that you were saying about the air conditioner. Yeah, we need to consider that it's also an unfair situation because there is many people that will not be able to afford an air conditioner, so it's not really a solution either. So, but in any case, yes, people is dying here because of the heat. Animals, there was this report of hundreds of monkeys falling just from the trees, and before that, the week before that, there were parrots as well. And of course, here in Yucatan, most of the city has air conditioning, but not all the small towns. So yeah, it's a big problem. And yeah, on the very hot Sunday, last Sunday, we have elections, and there was a massive participation, and we got our first president. But I don't think it means good news in terms of environment, at least not now. When she was a mayor in Mexico City, there was a couple of things that she did that clearly was against or was not eco-friendly. Like, for example, she built a bridge and for cars, and in order to do that, they destroy part of a wetland that it was of the very last natural resource in Mexico City, which it turns out it didn't solve the problems. It didn't solve the traffic that was supposed to be the problem, and because it was done all over the wetlands, when it's the rainy season, it gets flooded. So then you have floodings, you destroy part of the environment, of the reserve, and you didn't solve the issue that was the traffic in that area. Also, while she was in campaign, she promises to continue what López Obrador is doing. She's talking about the Tren Maya that we know it has several impacts in the environment. There has been deforestation of at least 10 million trees. They have polluted the water, they have injected concrete on water holes, and we are here in the peninsula, we don't have water surface bodies, we all depend on underground water, and now that water is polluted by concrete and all and metals that they have been injecting to build the railroad. So definitely in terms of environment, at least now it's not a good news. So maybe once that Claudia start her period, maybe she's distanced herself from López Obrador and all these programs that go against the environment.
I wanted
to
go.
It's not a clear evidence of that.
I wanted to go to a clip. The heat wave also killing those 150 howler monkeys found dead on the forest floor, according to Mexico's Environment Ministry, due to heat stroke, dehydration, malnutrition, or the spraying of crops with toxic agrochemicals. This is Mexican biologist Gilberto Pozas in the Mexican state of Tabasco.
We have registered 83 dead specimens. There are also orphan calves because many adult females have died. Some offspring have managed to survive. That is the problem with this species mortality in this very hot season in the state. The temperatures have reached 123 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wildlife is suffering because of the lack of water. There's been a lot of habitat degradation, so there is more light penetration, higher temperatures, and water scarcity. Above all, there's been an increase in the number of fires that damage the few habitats or refuges for these species.
Dr. Ruth Sadeh-Somoto, would you like to elaborate on that, the flora, the fauna, and how all life is affected?
Yeah, definitely. These extreme events that are becoming more frequent and more intense, and we knew that before. We knew that we have already observations all around the world in different regions that these extreme events will become more often and more frequent and more intense when they happen, and not only the heat wave, but floodings and extreme precipitation. So we knew all this, and we have been saying this for many, many years now. So it takes a toll in everything. So it affects health, it affects biodiversity, it affects, we, at the same time that we experience a heat wave, we also experience a very dry season. We are coming from last year as well. It was very low levels of precipitation that we have here in the country, partially because of El Nino, but partially because of this climate change. So as there is no water. We have experienced as well, not only Mexico, but in very in a lot of parts of the world, fires. We are getting these compound events in which you have all the perfect conditions for fires, for events that wouldn't happen otherwise. So we have dry, a dry environment, windy, and a lot of organic material. So then you have the perfect conditions to start the fires. And because it's so hot and because it's so little water, it's very hard to control those fires. So it's a massive devastation, plus the animals that they are dying because they are not able to adapt to this heat that we are experiencing. It's not normal. So even though here, the peninsula of Yucatan, normally we experience a hot weather, what we are experiencing right now goes beyond of what is normal. So we are, plus it has lasted for more than 1 month, but that we have had these conditions of 45 maximum degrees centigrade, and the minimums of 38, 35. So really not that minimum is not healthy anymore, not for humans, not for environment. And it doesn't seem that it's going to end soon. So,
We're going to end with Jeff Goodell. If you could comment on climate refugees as President Biden tries to shut down the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, limit the number of people who can come, the reasons people leave their countries and what they're affected by, and also the laws that prevent people, like in Texas, the attempt to stop people from even getting workers getting water breaks.
Yeah, well, you know, the one of the kind of rules of life is that when conditions get too intolerable, too hot, in this case, living things move on to find more suitable climates. That's what humans do. That's what plants do. That's what animals do. We all have to, in order to survive, find our kind of what I call in my book our Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot, not too cold. And what happens when it gets too hot? Crops fail, water sources fail, people move on. And that is what's happening at the U.S. border. Migration is a very complex topic. There's lots of reasons why people are on the move, but certainly climate change and crop failure and water scarcity is a big part of that. And so we're going to see a more chaotic planet as the climate heats up. In my book, I call heat the engine of planetary chaos, and that's what we're talking about here. So we're going to see more people trying to move across boundaries. We're going to see more politics driven by that kind of resistance to migration. We're seeing it in the United States right now. We're seeing it in Europe. We will see more and more of that. And in states like Texas, where I live, we have a governor who's a hard right MAGA Republican who has decided that, you know, he has passed legislation or signed legislation that prohibits any city or municipality in the state from passing any laws that require shade breaks or water breaks for workers during extreme heat conditions. The politics of this are perverse, they are brutal, they are barbaric, but that is the way our world is moving. You know, the idea that Governor Abbott has is a loss of productivity by giving people shade breaks, but it's really going back to the old kind of coal mining days where, you know, productivity is elevated above human life.
Well, we're going to continue to talk about this, of course, as we move into these incredibly hot summer months. And even those who have access to shade are determined by their wealth, particularly thinking of the unhoused population. Jeff Goodell, we want to thank you so much for being with us. New York Times piece you will link to that you just wrote, The Heat Wave Scenario That Keeps Climate Scientists Up at Night, author of The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. And we want to thank Dr. Ruth Sedoso Mota, climate scientist from the Institute of Engineering at National Autonomous University of Mexico today, speaking to us from Yucatan. When we come back, Black Women's Voices, the focus of a project from V-Day, the global activist movement to end violence against all women, gender expansive people, girls, and the earth. It's called Voices, a Sacred Sisterscape, back in 20 seconds.
Houseplants singing in the light of an open window. Was it breakfast you wanted or to feel the hunger of a new dawn? I was dancing in my living room before you posed for a portrait by the record player and perched your lips like a bloom song, chewing the shy places within. We ate mushrooms for breakfast and listened for what moved in our decaying minds. I followed the yes in my body and let you read the footsteps between our eyes.
Can't Look Away by Nico Segal, featuring Jamila Woods and Aja Monet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today back here in New York City, where on Wednesday the Empire State Building was lit up in red and gold to mark the 90th anniversary of the legendary Apollo Theater in Harlem. Well, the Apollo stages at the Victoria next door just hosted the launch of a new project and campaign by V-Day that's grounded in Black women's stories. V-Day is the global activist movement to end violence against all women and girls. The project is called Voices, a Sacred Sisterscape. This is part of the introduction to the audio play.
You are the sun. Where are you running to? Mother asked. Deeply concerned as we darted to hide under the shade. A shield from the sun? The cracks on our skin, she said, are a celebration of life. She could never understand the pride garnered from polished clay pot faces. In her heydays, every mark told a story. Laughter and tears amongst her sisters, a household feared and frowned upon when men came to pick wives. Laughing behind grandmother's back, tattooing their arms and legs with memories. The sweetest fruits have spots, she'd say. Let the sun burn, run in the wild, dance with the bees, pet the cubs, fight the hyenas. Be a girl of the savannah. Drink with the elephants. Swim with the hippos. Bathe with the flamingos. Be a girl of the Sahara.
The voice of Mumbai Kaigwa reading a piece by Ursula Nyaboke Gesemba called You Are the Sun in the opening of the audio play from V-Day called Voices, a Sacred Sisterscape. And this is another part of the play. This part was written by Frida Ndala Mukufa and read by Tashana Maddox. It's called My Rapist.
Why do we say my rapist? Like, does he belong to me? What part of him belongs to me? What part of him resides within me? What part of his is left with me? Why is he mine? I say my rapist like I'm proud to call him mine. I'm forced to say my rapist because it's double rape now. It identifies who I am. He makes up my identity. Someone I never asked to own. Someone I never wanted to own. Why is he always accompanied by my anger? Why does he fuel how I feel? Why is it that he is attached to my memories? Why is he mine?
Another excerpt from Voices, a Sacred Sisterscape. For more, we're joined by the project's director, Aja Monet, the Grammy-nominated poet and artistic creative director of V-Day's Voices campaign, and also with us, V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of V-Day and 1 Billion Rising. Her Obie Award-winning play, The Vagina Monologues, has been translated into 48 languages. Her memoir is Reckoning. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Aja, let's begin with you. I was privileged to be in the Apollo stages last Friday. It was actually right before a whole group, about 1,000 people, shut down the Brooklyn Museum around Palestine and the issue of divestment. But if you can talk about what you're doing with this project, considered a continuation of Vagina Monologues to be performed all over the world, or at least to be heard by many.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. First, I think in a time of extreme environmental violence, racial violence, and gender violence, I think it's a result of a lack of political imagination. And we know that art is an invitation to expand our participation in the world and the ways that we see the world. So we want this project to be in the legacy of projects like The Vagina Monologues for Colored Girls and the many ways that art has mobilized people to really go inward and then to examine their convictions about the ways that they show up in the world. And so that's really the impetus of this project, is to be an exploration of the interior landscape and how that manifests in the decisions we make towards each other.
And if you can talk about centering Black women's voices when this project came into being.
Yeah, so we began this project with an invitation by V to myself to be a part of V-Day, which is a global movement to end violence against women and girls, the Vagina Monologues. As you mentioned, it has an incredible legacy and tradition of using art to mobilize communities around all the many issues that we face, you know, in terms of sexual violence, assault, environmental violence, racial violence. And so post, I guess it would be the uprisings of 2020, even though we know that the movement for Black Lives has started long before that moment. But after George Floyd, I think it really encouraged the sort of invitation for people to look and examine themselves in the ways that they're showing up more deeply. And V had already been thinking about how to move the Vagina Monologues a little bit further from the center of the movement for V-Day. And so this moment sort of sparked, I think, the initiation of that urgent call to action to make something else the center of our work. And especially knowing that Black women are often at the forefront of our movements, our social movements, and Black feminism and what it has done for our movements, I think it just seemed appropriate for the time.
And V, if you can take it from there, in fact, that night, that day, it was afternoon, though it seemed like night, in the very dimly lit room where people had headphones on and were putting eye masks on to sit back and absorb the voices from around the world. You were sitting next to the great playwright Anna Deavere Smith, who read this amazing transcript, if you will, I should say, performed it, embodied it, of Mike Wallace interviewing the great playwright Lorraine Hansberry. But talk about what this really moment where you and Aja Monet have put out this piece that's going to be released around the world and how it's going to be released.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having us on, and I'm so proud of Aja and her whole team of amazing women who have created this piece out of, you know, there were 900 submissions of Black women around the world, and they have woven this into this stunning, stunning piece with Lefembert, who created the music, and made an offering in a moment where we are seeing books and histories being censored, where we're shutting down discourse. And it's so critical at this moment to tell our stories, to hear deeply. I loved Aja's whole vision of this piece, which is rather than looking at Black women, we needed to put our headphones on and our masks, and we needed to go into our minds and go into our beings and do embodied listening, where we heard stories, where we heard dreams, where we heard terrors, where we heard experiences we might not know. And through that, we begin to understand where we all connect, where we are all aligned. I think when we can hear each other's stories, when we can do deep, deep listening, that's when hate dissolves. That's when divisions dissolves. And I think, you know, just being in that room up at the Apollo and seeing all those people lying on couches and lying on mats and really being with each other deeply in the listening to the stories and to the dreams and to the visions of Black women was such a powerful experience for so many people, and will be as this piece begins to spread out into the world.
So let's play another clip from Voices. This is called Prison.
My name is Rosalind Smith, and I thought I would die in prison. The day I got the decision from the parole board saying that I was going to be released was one of the happiest days in my life. While in prison, I had all these hopes and dreams about what my freedom would look like. I was going to get a job, find a place for me and my daughter to live, travel, enjoyed all the things that I missed while I was incarcerated. But to my surprise, none of those dreams panned out the way I thought. Prison didn't prepare me for reentry. I was incarcerated in 1979 and came home 39 years later in 2018. I was stuck in a time warp. Tokens were metro cards, phones were cellular, letters were emails. I returned to a world that I was foreign to, and the world that I was in didn't give me any kind of skills to carry forth. I was trying to establish myself in a new community, and I was at the age of people retiring, preparing for retirement at least. I was free from prison, but not from the struggles or stigma of a formerly incarcerated woman.
That's the voice of Rosalind Smith from the piece Prison, which is part of this medley, this mosaic, this collage of voices from around the world, part of Voices, Sisterscape. Aja Monet, how and when is this being released?
Thank you for asking. Well, it's going to be released on June 11th across the globe on all streaming platforms. Something we want to also illustrate or to demonstrate for people is that while this is an audio play or an audio experience, it has been a campaign. So before it first launches on June 11th, we also premiered a launch in Ghana in, I think it was December 22nd, 2022. It was with Angela Davis, and it was an effort for us to not just be about the aesthetic phenomenon about art, but real life, to, you know, to transform us from being, solidarity is about us being not just spectators, but actors in the reality of our lives. And so this is the way we've launched this and the way that we've campaigned the project is to also be in process with one another as Black women, that we're so diverse across our identities and across the ways that we culturally express ourselves. And I think that that's something that I hope people take away with, that it's not just about what we have endured and our oppression and the things that we've experienced, but also who we've become in spite and because of those things, and what ways we've fostered relationships and community and movements because of the perspectives and sort of the interior examination that those issues, troubles, tribulations have spawned in us. And so it'll be launched on June 11th with the support of Blackstone, and it'll be on all streaming platforms, and we hope people will take the piece into their communities and organize their own listening exhibitions and community centered sort of, you know, spaces with one another to really engage in embodied listening.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. The date is June 11th. That voices will be released around the world on every streaming platform. I want to thank Aja Monet, the artistic creative director of V-Day's Voices campaign. It's called Voices, a Sisterscape. And also V, formerly called Eve Ensler, founder of V-Day and 1 Billion Rising. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Bokadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, broadcasting from the campus of Carnegie Mellon University at 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Now you masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can see through your mask. That never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand, you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten their triggers for others to fire, then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion as young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can never be hurled, the fear to bring children into the world, or threaten my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? The talk out of turn. You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned. There's one thing I know, though I'm younger than you, Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your debt takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
Kimmy Joe here. You are in Pinckney Hall on WRCT. Got a couple of things going on here. Well, one thing that's going on, although it won't help me to tell you about it, is that if you are trying to listen to us on the internet at WRCT.org, it's not working very well. But of course, if you're trying to do that, you're not going to hear me say that, but the problem has been reported and hopefully it'll be fixed soon. What we are going to do today is, I don't know how this came to mind, it's not a birthday or anniversary, but we are celebrating Jack Holtzman and Elektra Records. Jack founded Elektra in the mid-1950s. Interestingly enough, he was a student at St. John's College in Annapolis, which is a very small school. Enrollment in the 50s, I don't think, was ever much more than 300 people on campus. But he founded, he was a student there and founded Elektra Records. And several years previously, Ahmet Erdogan was a student there, and he went on.